A boy stands at the edge of Harlem, fists clenched, unable to make the sounds that would stop the laughter. His mind races with perfect sentences, but his mouth betrays him, turning crisp words into stumbling syllables that invite mockery. So he swings instead. It's a story that could have ended in prison or an early grave, another cautionary tale from the streets. But Walter Dean Myers transformed his fury into something else entirely, a literary career that would speak for millions of young people who felt trapped between who they were and who the world expected them to be. Bad Boy isn't just a memoir. It's a roadmap through the minefield of growing up black and brilliant in mid-20th century America, where intelligence felt like a burden and survival often meant hiding your best qualities. We inherit more than our parents' eyes or our grandmother's smile. We carry entire histories in our bones, stories of migration and survival, of choices made under impossible circumstances. Myers arrived in this world already connected to Lucas D. Dennis, his great-great-uncle, who had been enslaved on a Virginia plantation. After the Civil War, the family moved to Martinsburg, West Virginia, where Mary Dolly Green gave birth to Walter in 1937. When Mary died shortly after delivering Walter's sister, their father, George, faced an impossible situation: 7 children and no partner. The solution came from Florence Dean, George's first wife from Baltimore, who had remarried and moved to Harlem with Herbert. Florence and Herbert brought young Walter into their Harlem home, and suddenly his identity became wonderfully complicated. Florence herself embodied America's melting pot, born to a German immigrant mother and Native American father. Walter now belonged to a family tree that stretched from slavery to Harlem's emerging black middle class, from German immigration to Native American heritage. This complex ancestry gave him multiple lenses through which to view the world, though he wouldn't fully appreciate this gift until much later. Think about the stories your family doesn't tell at dinner, the uncomfortable truths about where you came from and how you survived. Harlem in the 1940s was young Walter's universe. Division Street meant Aunt Nancy's bakery, pushcarts, the matzo factory's warm smell, and Jewish boys who were sometimes playmates, sometimes adversaries. He learned early social dynamics. Neighborhood boys taught him to bully Jewish boys who wouldn't fight back until those same boys lured them around corners and fought fiercely. The best times came when Mama didn't work. They'd walk 125th Street together, and at home she'd read true romance magazines aloud and patiently help Walter learn to read. By first grade, Walter read at second grade level and was physically large enough to skip ahead. But Mrs. Dworkin objected, "He can't speak well enough." Walter had no idea what she meant. In his mind, his words came out perfectly clear. The truth crashed into him in second grade when Manuel Bonilla taunted him with "daba, daba, daba," mimicking his pronunciation. Walter's response was immediate. He punched Manuel, earning his first trip to the principal's office. The family moved to Morningside Avenue. At 8, Walter received his own house key, a symbol of growing up and a practical tool for smuggling comic books past Mrs. Dodson, who'd convinced Mama that comics were roadmaps to the jailhouse. School became a battlefield. Speech therapy frustrated him because he couldn't hear the problem everyone else heard. He excelled at reading and spelling, but when kids laughed at his pronunciation, Walter would yell or punch them, establishing a dangerous pattern of using physical force to compensate for communication challenges. After a disastrous third-grade report card, Walter's brother-in-law Frank drilled him with 100 daily arithmetic problems. One mistake meant another 100. At school, Mrs. Parker made Walter cookie monitor, warning him about fighting. But after Easter vacation, an accidental scuffle with Maurice Bunny Fleetwood destroyed everything. When Bunny accidentally hit Walter twice, Mrs. Parker blamed Walter. After she berated him, Walter threw a book that accidentally hit her. She threatened reform school, a common threat hanging over black boys. That day, Walter became violently ill. Emergency surgery removed his appendix, and, disobeying orders, he rode his bicycle, reopening his incision. During recovery, something shifted. Reading became his refuge. Books offered clarity that spoken language couldn't. Words behaved predictably, stories followed logical patterns, and nobody laughed at how he pronounced sentences in his mind. Mr. Irwin Lasher became the first male teacher in Walter's life, beginning with brutal honesty. You're a bright boy, and that's what you're going to be in this class. The inevitable clash came when Walter's pretend kick connected with the teacher's backside. Despite Walter's wild swings, the WW2 veteran easily subdued him. Instead of sending a note home, Mr. Lasher personally walked Walter to meet his mother, a gesture communicating respect rather than punishment. He explained Walter's test scores showed intelligence, but his behavior threatened to waste it. Then he said something that cut through all defenses. "We need more smart Negro boys. We don't need tough Negro boys." This direct approach, acknowledging both Walter's intelligence and the social context of being a young black man in America, resonated profoundly. Mr. Lasher placed Walter in speech therapy and gave him leadership positions coaching slower readers. By year's end, Walter's grades improved dramatically. Think about the teachers who changed your trajectory. Often, it wasn't their curriculum, but their ability to see past your defenses to the person you could become. By summer 1949, Walter's world darkened. His Uncle Lee's murder, robbed, beaten, and stomped in an alley, transformed the household. Walter's father became almost unrecognizable, wild-eyed, incoherent, consumed by mourning. He turned intensely to religion, spending Sundays in silence listening to radio preachers. The funeral revealed adults crying openly with distorted faces, showing Walter a level of pain he'd never witnessed. This tragedy coincided with Walter's growing awareness of race in America. He joined a special progress class at Junior High School 43, completing 2 grades in 1 year. Among equally smart students, Walter felt increasingly isolated. They studied slavery, which made black students uncomfortable as they tried to reconcile their belief in fairness with these disturbing facts. His friendship with Eric became strained. Walter realized he wouldn't be welcome at many parties Eric attended simply because he was black. By 1951, Walter recognized that everything he studied, all the authors, all historical figures except George Washington Carver, were white men. He resented how whiteness seemed central to assigning value. His earlier hope that intelligence could transcend race was crumbling. At 15, starting his junior year at Stuyvesant High School, Walter felt completely lost about his future while classmates excitedly discussed college plans. Many Southern colleges didn't accept black students. Historically, black colleges existed, but voluntary segregation contradicted everything Walter believed. His speech impediment complicated matters. A family friend crushed his legal ambitions by telling him he couldn't be a lawyer because he didn't speak well enough. When a coach invited him to join the track team, Walter agreed, but never showed up, too ashamed to admit he couldn't afford shoes or athletic wear. At 15, Walter was summoned to the guidance counselor's office after missing 3 weeks of school. He'd leave home each morning, but exit at 59th Street to wander Central Park, comparing literary translations, watching foreign films, or writing dark poems. Unlike a defiant truant, he desperately wanted to be part of the system, but didn't know how. Surprisingly, his report card showed he'd passed classes he rarely attended, as if the school was looking for ways to advance him. At home, his mother's drinking worsened. He retreated to his room, worrying about the connection between intellectual interests and being labeled homosexual, especially in the black community where reciting poetry and listening to classical music were sometimes stereotyped as faggot behaviors. Though he knew logically that loving books didn't make him gay, he increasingly hid these interests. When his mother discovered his truancy, she accompanied him to Stuyvesant. All his forged notes were produced. She was amazed at how well he'd copied her signature. He'd missed nearly 30 days. During a private conference, she mentioned Walter's childhood scarlet fever and nervousness. Walter could remain at Stuyvesant if he agreed to supervision by a city agency. He was officially labeled disturbed. January began Walter's final term in panic. While he wanted a miracle, he spent his time reading labor movement history, François Villon, and Siegfried Sassoon's war poems. He was drawn to the violence of war, imagining himself in trenches, weighing words against dying, believing death could answer failed promise. As spring approached, his anxieties increased, books became harder to understand, and his writing contained obscure references he couldn't understand days later. Walter intercepted school letters and lied about his attendance. When he finally gathered courage to go to Stuyvesant, he discovered the school year had ended, graduation ceremonies held, the senior class moved on. It was over. He walked uptown crying, so far from what he wanted for his life. At 16, Walter was adrift, pretending to attend school while spending days in the park, unable to read or write. On his 17th birthday, he enlisted with help from a black sergeant who fabricated a clean record. When he told his parents, his mother cried. He couldn't articulate his shame or explain why he needed to escape Harlem. His father gave him a Navy New Testament and money belt. After Army service teaching efficient killing, he drifted through factory floors and construction sites. His turning point came eating lunch on a curb, covered in debris, when he saw disgust in a passing girl's face. Remembering his teacher's advice, "Don't stop writing," he bought a composition book and began again. In the garment district, discrimination hit hard. A white boy was immediately trained on machines, while Walter was reassigned to push a hand truck. When he protested, the boss said, "Take it or leave." Walter walked out. Ashamed, he couldn't articulate his feelings about being relegated to manual labor because of race. He buried himself in reading, particularly Lin Yutong's The Gay Genius, about Su Teng Po, a Chinese poet who advanced through testing rather than racial considerations. His intelligence meant nothing in a world seeing only his skin color, yet something in Walter refused to accept this verdict as final. Writing became Walter's refuge. He sent poems to literary magazines and got published. James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues gave him permission to write about his black urban experience. When his half-brother Wayne died in Vietnam, he processed grief through writing for Essence magazine. John O. Killens introduced him to Baldwin and the Harlem Writers Guild. In 1968, Walter won a contest for black writers run by the Council on Interracial Books for Children, launching his career in young people's literature. Visiting his parents with a new book, his mother asked what he did. His father emphasized Walter was a man now. Later, she heard her proudly telling a friend her son types stories for a living. Writing gave Walter a world where his skills mattered, among people who appreciated language and ideas. Walter Dean Meyer's journey shows that the path from bad boy to celebrated author isn't about erasing who you were. It's about transforming struggles into strength. Every punch thrown in frustration, every day hiding in Central Park reading instead of attending class, every moment of not belonging became material for stories that spoke to millions of young people who felt the same way. The boy who couldn't speak clearly wrote words that echoed across generations, giving voice to countless young people who felt invisible, misunderstood, and trapped between worlds.